Welcome, welcome, Mush fam, to another episode of Mushroom Revival Podcast. We are so excited to have another episode out to you guys, and this whole podcast is dedicated to bridging the gap between you, our lovely, lovely listeners, and the fantastic, funky, wacky world of fungi. The topic of today's podcast, which we have an amazing guest on, Lila Darwish.
Hi. Hi, Lila. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So I will give a quick bio to our listeners about your amazing work. Lila, you are a community organizer, an author, permaculture designer, educator, urban gardener, and grassroots herbalist with a deep commitment to environmental justice, decolonization, food sovereignty, and to providing accessible and transformative tools for communities dealing with toxic contamination of their land and drinking water. You've taught grassroots bioremediation for a diversity of groups and communities in Canada and the United States, and published this awesome book in 2013, Earth Repair, A Grassroots Guide to Healing Toxic and Damaged Landscapes, which is such a hefty book. It covers so many different avenues of bioremediation, and we're pumped to get into it.
I've read your book like four times, and I've had... I've had like four different copies, and I keep giving it out to people to borrow, and they just don't give it back because it's so good. And I love it. It's an amazing book, and I highly recommend all of our listeners go and buy it right now. It's an incredible book.
I appreciate it. Thank you. And I like getting around. So give it out. I always tell people, like, ask your library to carry it, you know, so then it's like available to people for free. But I just want to see that book make its rounds.
Yeah, there needs to be like hundreds of more copies.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk about your story of how you got into this kind of work?
Sure. First of all, I'm stoked to be on the podcast and getting to speak with both of you. It sounds like you're doing amazing work with the mushrooms and the book that you also wrote. So that's all wonderful. How I got into this work is I spent a lot of my adult life doing environmental justice work. I'm from Alberta, Canada, which people know is kind of ground zero for the tar sands and for oil spills and things like that. And so I spent, you know, a good 5-6 years organizing and working with frontline communities who were getting directly impacted by, you know, oil and toxic contamination, and where people were getting really sick from what was happening to the land, you know, in terms of the water was poisoned, their land was poisoned. And in all those situations, you know, you were always kind of watching people kind of hoping that the company or the government would step in and clean things up, and never getting that justice. And so I think that just really broke my heart. And I was in the work as an activist, and I was sounding the alarm, and I was like helping build kind of solidarity and all these things. But at the end of the day, there wasn't that ability to heal the land and to therefore heal people. Because if the land is toxic, if the land is broken, then, you know, it impacts all of us. And so I think part of me just really wanted to see, how do we find a way to start kind of detoxing and regenerating these landscapes that are being destroyed, and really supporting the people who are on the front lines of that. And at the same time, kind of doing some of that work, I was also getting into permaculture and learning how to farm. I spent a year doing kind of farming and farm apprenticeships, and also coming at it from the angle of, you know, you're getting really passionate about growing food and growing food in urban areas if you're trying to really be local and sustainable. But we also live in these urban jungles that have dealt with a lot of toxicity because of how we live and what's been on the land, whether it's factories, whatever we dumped. It's just this kind of long list of, you know, toxic issues. And so, you know, I was getting super passionate about wanting to grow something everywhere I could find. And then also the reality of being like, how do we grow things in a healthy way and not just come in there and do that really human thing of doing it for us, or we put, you know, like we put a raised bed and we say, boom, I brought in the soil, I built this thing, look at this urban garden. But how do we actually bring back the soil and build a garden that is from the ground up that heals the land? I just really want to go that deep with things. And so all of that together kind of got me into the topic of bioremediation. And when I was first kind of looking into it, there wasn't a lot of classes you could take. There wasn't that many other books written on it. There was scientific stuff, and there was books like Paul Stamets' books on micromediation, and that all got me jazzed up. But I was kind of looking for, why aren't we doing it? Why don't we see collectives of people kind of going out there when we see oil spills? Why aren't people responding a certain way? And that just got me wanting to learn more And by learning more, I got a really weird opportunity to write a book. And so that just made it go into hyperdrive.
One of my favorite things about your book is you start out chapter one, you know, talking about it's easy for people in the permaculture space, in the healthy eating space, and like, you know, any space trying to improve the land or people or et cetera, to totally just glaze over decolonization and kind of glaze over that social aspect. And, you know, in the earth justice community and like climate change, there's an aspect that a lot of people in the space kind of glaze over, which is unfortunate, of, you know, who does this affect first and foremost? And where are these like catastrophes happening, and who are they really attacking and affecting foremost? And so I really appreciated your first chapter, which is decolonization and environmental justice, and just talking about the symbiosis of how all these systems interact. So can you talk about that a little bit, and how bioremediation supports decolonization?
Yeah. And I actually had to fight my publisher for that chapter.
No, I bet. Yeah, for sure.
Is it permaculture? And I was like, I'm writing it. No, this is how the book is going to go. And I mean, part of that is because my activism, you know, a lot of things that I've learned has been shaped by really powerful indigenous allies that I've worked with and communities that I've worked with. And again, that's a lot of my desire came from trying to work and support communities and wanting to offer this as an option, to offer bioremediation in the sense of, you know, again, when we're depending on colonial systems and colonial governments and colonial companies who are, you know, going at things in a really dishonorable way and you know, have a certain view of the land, the outcome is often going to be the same. And when it comes to, again, trying to get justice, trying to get them to care about, you know, most impacted communities, whether they are, you know, communities of color in Houston that got hit really hard by the toxic contamination that was left over by Hurricane Harvey, whether they're indigenous folks, you know, along pipeline routes who are getting, you know, dealing with spills and stuff like that. There's a lot of things where the impacts of toxicity impact indigenous communities and communities of color and low-income folks far more than white communities and rich communities. Now, that's not always the case, but it's often the case. And again, people's ability to get their any kind of remediation done is often based, you know, along some very racial, very class lines. And then even the kind of remediation that we see when we're looking at the government and conventional remediation isn't always coming from a deep love of regenerating the ecosystem and people's ability to live close to the land. It's often coming from, you know, there's a certain financial line there. There's a certain line of we got to get this done as quick as possible, public relations, things like that. You see that a lot in the oil industry. And not that there aren't good people in that industry potentially trying to clean things up in a good way, but there is often of things of we clean it up to a certain point and then we're done. And the people whose, you know, traditional land that is, they don't get to say that they're done, right? And they have a longer obligation and sense of responsibility for their descendants and their ancestors. And that keeps, you know, that work going. And so people will often, I think, when you're coming at bioremediation from either a colonized or decolonized perspective, it will look a lot different because there are industry folks who do bioremediation. You know, there's people within the bioremediation world that I know who I think are pretty colonial in how they approach it. You know, like there's a way to do something where you're not involving community, where you're not, you know, working with respecting the landscape that you're in or the people who are there, you know, where you're defining your healing benchmark a certain way, that really depends on how much decolonization work you've done. And I think even thinking about when we're working with, you know, mushrooms or plants or bacteria, because when we're talking about bioremediation, we're talking about, you know, phytoremediation is working with the plants, the microbes, microbial remediation, micromediation is the mushrooms. And when we're talking about that, there is a way to look at these natural allies as just these things that we throw on the landscape, their tools, their technologies, versus the fact that they're living beings. And that if we want to do this work powerfully and correctly, you have to kind of court them and you have to come to these different beings in a way that, you know, you're working with them. They're not doing the work for you. You have to do things like modify your landscape so they can survive. You have to feed them what they need to feed. You need to try to understand how they live and how, you know, they do their work. Because if you don't understand those things, then you will not always be good at what you're doing. If you don't walk onto a landscape and actually know how to read the land and understand kind of what that ecosystem needs, because you're just coming in there and saying one size fits all, which is a very colonial way of thinking, again, you're not going to necessarily end up with, you know, the right healing process. And so that's all something that I think is really wrapped up in bioremediation and doing it in a good way. One thing I noticed when I first wrote the book and then started teaching, I did a whole round of teaching for about 2 years after writing the book, is that I also noticed this very colonial way that people wanted to use the work, in the sense of they pick one thing, and no matter what the issue was, they wanted to do it like that. Like the amount of people who just wanted to throw mycelium on something without understanding what was going on or whether it even worked. And this weird thing of people kind of wanting to just have that solution and get to be famous by it without actually really caring whether it was healing the land.
Right.
You know? And that happens often in this work. So you have to kind of sift through the bullshit and the beauty of it. But I was constantly kind of thrown back by, you know, trying to say to people, hey, that's not going to work, but why don't we try X, Y, Z? And them saying, nope, I want the easy way out. And to me also, the easy way out is often the colonial way too, right? Because you want that quick kind of, it's easy, it's reduced, it's reductionist. It's just like we want to kind of almost keep extracting in a different way because we want to do the easy thing, not do the work and get famous for it.
And then get a pat on the back for, you know, having just done it.
Yeah. Yeah. And where's the earth in it all? Like, did you actually do the healing work?
Absolutely. And in your book, you mentioned the three forms of bioremediation. Can you quickly just go over like what those define phytoremediation, bacterial remediation, and then maybe at what point you would choose to use one over the other?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when I think about bioremediation as a whole, I think about working with, you know, plants, mushrooms, and microorganisms to detox and regenerate broken, contaminated landscapes and water, right? Both land and water. And when we're talking about working with any of these, there's different ways that they do their work. We're either trying, so depending on the contamination of the landscape, you know, if it's a heavy metal, we're trying to find ways to extract it, or we're trying to find ways to bind it and immobilize it. If it's a chemical, we're trying to find ways to break it down, right? And so depending on what you're dealing with, it can sometimes make more sense to use one thing or another, you know? When we're talking about working with plants, phytoremediation, and that's really common because a lot of people know how to work with plants. It's a lot more simple than knowing how to cultivate a mushroom for some people, right? And with microbes, they can't even see it. So you often see plants in some ways as being the one most in the literature. When we're working with plants, you know, a plant can remediate toxicity as far as its roots can go. And so, you know, if you have really, really deep contamination and your roots don't necessarily make it to that, you're not necessarily doing the phyto. But depending on what you're doing, plants have that ability, depending on the plant, to, they can hyperaccumulate heavy metals, and which means that they kind of bring up the heavy metals and store it in their body. And then you can kind of remove that plant and find a safe way to dispose of it. They can also help with the breakdown of chemicals by either kind of pulling the chemicals kind of up, or they can have these really interesting relationships with mycorrhiza, with microbes in the soil that can assist with the breakdown of contaminants at the soil level. So there's a lot of things that the plants can do. They're also really great for any kind of water work. If you're doing things like floating islands, constructed wetlands, they can be really great again at working with the water and in that same way of pulling up the contamination through their root systems, but also again, this constant partnership with the microbes. And we see this often, for example, in floating islands where we have plants kind of in a certain formation floating in water, trying to uptake different contaminants, and especially chemicals or excess nutrients, right? We actually see bacteria grow along the roots of the plant, making a biofilm. And people always think it's the plant that's doing all the remediation, but it's actually the microbes, right? Doing a huge amount of that. So to me, when we're talking about the remediation, it's all connected. When we're talking about microbial remediation, it's working with microorganisms. And great ways to do that are with, you know, really microorganism-laden compost, working with actively aerated compost tea correctly. Not everybody knows how to make an actual alive compost tea. Working at finding ways to bring back microorganisms with a huge diversity into your contaminated land, because the more diversity you bring of a microorganism and different types of it and the more numbers, the more chance you have of one of these microorganisms wanting to break down the chemical that's there. And to me, microorganisms, I often think of them as breaking down chemicals. I think of them as incredibly amazing allies when it comes to hydrocarbon and oil remediation. And there's actually quite a bit of research on that. I think it's also, you know, if you're looking to bind heavy metals, microorganisms can be very helpful at doing that. And that's often, again, working at, you know, with compost, with different amendments, but try to find a way to lock certain heavy metals in place and make them less bioavailable. But yeah, it's a microorganisms in a way are a fairly simple way to do this. There are ways that you can up your game with microbial remediation if you know the tricks, in terms of finding ways to bring in certain microorganisms that we know will break down certain chemicals, finding ways to amend your compost with things like phosphorus and things like that that feed your microorganisms. There's a lot there. It's all in the book, but I think of that as a really interesting option. And then, you know, the one that I know y'all are most excited about, which is microremediation. And to me, mushrooms, I mean, people get so excited about mushrooms. I think it's because there's a lot of mystery around mushrooms. And also, it hasn't been kind of pushed the same way that phyto and micro has been. And also, industry hasn't touched it. When you look at plants and bacteria, there are quite a few industrial applications in terms of remediation of those. But for a lot of what I've noticed, I haven't seen industry trying to use mushrooms for oil spills or anything like that. Yet they are, when we look at remediation, fungi is the species that has the ability to break down some of our most complex contaminants and to break it into smaller pieces so that the plants and the mushrooms can start to do their work. And so if you look at it that way, it's just, I find if I'm trying to work with heavy metals, I'd be looking more at microbes and I'd be looking more at plants primarily. But if I was working with certain chemicals, especially complex chemicals, hydrocarbons, things like dioxin and PCBs and stuff like that, I think if you are adept enough at cultivating mushrooms and you have the right environment to kind of bring them in, I think they're a really good kind of tool to work with kind of off the bat. I think the thing where it falls down is not a lot of people know how to do it correctly. I also think the way that mushrooms, both if we have water issues, looking at either microremediation or phytoremediation or a combination of both, depending on where you're intercepting the water, is a beautiful thing to work with, because I think they both play a part in that. But yeah, it's a big topic. I could talk about that for a long time.
It is super complex. And, you know, what I've come across is, you know, what you're talking about is this inspiration flu. So maybe someone read Mycelium Running and they think, you know, they're so hyped on mushrooms can save the world or whatever. And they think they can just take some like a spent mushroom oyster block and just throw it on an oil spill and it saves the day.
Oh my God. I've seen it.
And it's like, yeah, it's the general of like, I don't know. I don't want to bash Paul Stamets. I think he's amazing. He got me into mushrooms. He's such an inspiration. He's like incredible for ringing the bell to get people into the mushroom scene. And for that, I'm like, have unbelievable amount of admiration for him. However, I think there's a negative, I call it like the Stamets flu, when people get so hyped that it's actually like detrimental, where they kind of, like you're saying, they think they can just throw some mushrooms on anything and it'll all just disappear.
Yeah. And I literally, there was an oil spill in Vancouver back in, I don't know if it was 2014, 2015. And I remember meeting with, there was this group of folks who were very excited. This is Vancouver, Canada. Very excited to do bioremediation. And they didn't really have experience, but they had so much passion. I remember meeting with them and being kind of like, okay, so yo, if you're going to do this, let's think about some stuff. Because this was, you know, there was some oil washing up on, you know, a fairly like sandy, rocky shore. The waves are crashing, right? And these kids were just like, nope, I'm taking this spent spawn and like sprinkling it along the beach. And every time they did it, it literally was like a wave just came and sucked that right back, you know? And it's like a beach, it's like sun exposed, all these things where, again, going back to, you're working with mushrooms. How does a mushroom want to live? You know, A, it definitely doesn't want to drown. And B, does it actually want to be baking in the sun? Like, have you provided cover? Have you provided anything for your ally to actually survive, to do the important work you want it to do? Instead of just saying, this is exciting. And again, it's a beautiful thing. I mean, hey, I was guilty of this. I remember I used to make actively aerated compost tea, and it wasn't alive. I just learned it in a really magical way, and I felt all witchy about it, and it smelled really earthy, and I thought that's what made it alive, and it was just the smell of molasses, right? Like, I didn't bubble it properly, none of that stuff. And so it's like, you have to sometimes learn, you know, if you're going to take this a step up, and if we are working with contaminated land, that shit is hard. Like, this is like, toxic contamination is something we've inherited, and it is not easy to fix at all. And so you kind of have to come to it being like, if I'm going to go up against this challenge, I got to bring my A game, you know? And it isn't easy, but the beauty to me is I don't think it's exciting. Like, bioremediation doesn't captivate me because one solution, boom, we're done. It captivates me because if you think of the earth as a body or as someone that you love and you want to help them with their healing, you're trying to think in that holistic, complex way of what's going on. And you're seeing all the weird ways that things are connected. I had some friends who did oil spill work, and you know, one of the things that they learned, they kind of came at it first just trying to work with fungi, and they had some success with it, but it got to a point where the fungi only broke it down so much. And then when they started bringing in kind of the very specialized, like, actively aerated compost tea that they made with petrophilic bacteria, petrophilic being oil loving bacteria, it took it like 5 steps farther, right? And to me, nature works like that. It doesn't just do these monocultures. It works with a diversity of species and a diversity of relationships and things going on. And so, you know, you would think that humans who are really in love with nature and really want to embrace this would kind of apply themselves the same way.
Yeah, I'm curious, and I've been wanting to have this conversation with someone for a while, like many years. And it really hit me when I was doing research for the book that I wrote on micro-remediation, and I went into it very, very starry-eyed and very like, there's no research on this. This is like the frontier and mushrooms to save the world and blah, blah, blah. And throwing, you know, mycelium at cigarette butts and like very starry-eyed. But once you dig in a little bit, like, there is dozens of like 600 page books on micro-remediation and like way more on bacterial remediation, way more on phytoremediation. Like, the whole global market for bioremediation technology is $32 billion in 2016, and it's estimated to double in the next 5 years. Like, it's a huge industry in terms of bacteria, plants, and fungi being used. And I mean, just focusing on mushrooms or fungi, this is huge in an industrial scale. Like, it's not just mycelium running, just throwing oyster mycelium. There's like, this has been done in for the last 50 to 100 years in dozens and dozens of different industrial commercial applications in massive bioreactors, massive biopiles. Like, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of scientific research papers on industrial applications of micro-remediation. And there seems to be a disconnect with, like, most people that I've talked to say there is no research and there is no industrial application and there is nothing out there. And so let's just throw mushrooms at it. And like, we're pioneering the field. And, you know, we saw a Netflix documentary on mushrooms that the director thought that Paul Stamets invented micro-remediation. And, you know, obviously for them, it's new. And yeah, it's just like, it's interesting. And I see this a lot in the United States where mushroom culture and even any connection with like nature itself is very new to us. And so we get very starry-eyed if any, like, I don't know, and get this, to be hopeful is very great. And I'm like, I love people being hopeful and inspired. And I think it's like an amazing trait. But there's a huge disconnect between the research and industrialization of these techniques and people just starting out and getting really interested in it.
Yeah. And it's interesting.
And I'm curious why that is. And like, you know, it could be just like resources. A lot of these books are really expensive. A lot of these research papers are like, you know, people don't know about different programs to access research papers. So they don't know that they can email scientific researchers, or they, you know, it's too complex, too scientific for them, or, you know, they don't have the funding. Like if you're trying to grassroots remediate, like you don't have, you're not an engineer. You don't know how to engineer a whole complex bioreactor or like have $1 million to clean up a huge like oil spill. So I'm curious, like where do you envision the bridge between the extensive research out there and industrial practices and just like the average person?
Yeah. Yeah. I would say it's a lot there.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm really passionate about this topic. So
no, that's great. I would say, I mean, there's a few things. I think, I mean, in some ways, like I know when I was writing the book, I did find a lot of you know, like research papers on different things people had done and different studies that they're doing around, you know, what plants do what and myco and micro remediation. I do think the myco one is the least kind of explored from what I was seeing on the industrial side. I also think that, okay, there's so many pieces here. One, I think, I mean, I waded through those academic papers because I had to, because if I was going to write a book, I didn't want it to be based on rumors.
Right.
People will literally tell you that a plant works for phytoremediation because they like the look of it and because it didn't die. And you're like, that doesn't mean it actually picked any metal up, you know? And so you actually do have to go and see in the scientific literature what plants did what, and not just what did what, but like how effective were they? Because a plant can like hyperaccumulate a certain metal. You know, we get really excited about sunflowers hyperaccumulating lead, and it's not the best plant for that. It's okay, right. And it looks super snazzy and people love the visual, but alpine pennycress, which is a lot less dramatic looking, you know, is actually the quicker lead remediator, right? And so it's like trying to like, I just wanted to give people a resource that was as legit as possible in terms of the background information. And so I kind of took the sacrifice of reading through that scientific stuff. But to be honest, it was long, it was arduous, and a lot of it was like, you're just like, why couldn't you just write this straightforward, to be honest? And that to me is why there isn't necessarily more people knowing. And I think that's a little bit on universities and scientists to be like, if you are doing this research, you need to find a way to share it with communities who are the most impacted by it. Because, you know, you making a paper and it going into a journal and no one knowing what the fuck goes on with it is not helpful to the people on the ground doing this work.
Exactly.
Or the people who need to be doing this work and who would be empowered to know this. And I think on the other side, I had a friend who went into mycology, who she was doing her grad studies in mycology, and she was studying some, you know, I mean, I love mushrooms, but I love fungi because of what they do in the land. And with, I love mycomedicinals and stuff like that. I'm not one of those people who will geek out on random species. For all of y'all who are like that, high five, but that's not me. And I had this friend who was doing a mycology degree where she was studying some, you know, really rare form of fungi, but it wasn't for any purpose in terms of an application. And so it makes me think about some of these departments being like, why aren't you not harnessing your knowledge in your labs and looking at these contaminated landscapes, partnering with these communities and doing the work in a way that we all see it, you know, because that would actually make a difference. And you have, you look at the universities, they have the resources, they have the funding, they have the laboratory, they have everything that actually can be challenging on the grassroots level. And so I would like to see more of a proactive stance from the researchers to actually bring their work out into community. I think that would be amazing. And I think that means that we would actually be seeing more projects done at a certain scale. The other thing you see is that, yes, there are a lot of studies, but, you know, these are studies like they're field kind of studies, but they're not necessarily done at large scale. And that's a big thing that people say with bioremediation is that, you know, we haven't seen someone, let's say, you know, you take on a huge oil spill that way. We've seen some smaller spills done that way. But like, you know, we haven't seen these big scale things. You know, it's a big dream of mine to be like, hey, can we bioremediate the tar sands? That's massive. That's at a level, and also a level of toxicity and a cluster of toxicity that we don't know if we could do that. So it is also kind of pulling back some of the visionary and also delusionary thinking of being like, what can we actually do with this? And I think we could push this farther if there was more support for it. And the industrial way is not always the way to go because, again, it has different benchmarks. And one of the reasons why we don't see bioremediation at scale and being used by industries, they might have done a lot of research into it, but we're not seeing it be applied. You know, there's a reason why the oil spill industry, there's an oil spill industry. I'm very passionate about oil spills. It's one of the reasons why I got into this work. There's an industry that's all around, kind of an empire around oil spill cleanup. You can go to conferences and the amount of money and the amount of contractors and the amount of research going in by the companies, by all these kind of other kind of remediation cleanup companies, it's massive. And the groups that, you know, the big oil extractors go with time and time again, you know, we're looking at conventional remediation. They consistently will go with booms. They'll consistently go with dispersants, even if they're toxic, because their objective is to go quick, to get it out of sight, out of mind, as quick as you possibly can. And working with biological interventions is not always quick. And not only is not always quick, you can't have stockpiles of them the same way you can have a stockpile of a chemical that you just throw on a spill, regardless of the ecological impact of that. And so that's something we see. I've heard government people say this. I've heard company people say this, that yes, we could be doing some of these things with our ecological allies, like with plants and mushrooms and bacteria, but they, A, are trying to work too quickly. B, already have certain contracts in place with existing people where they're all making money off each other, right? Like a lot of the ways that they clean up petroleum is actually using petroleum products, which is awkward, you know? So there's all these things where it's super complex. But to me, it doesn't take away the thing that we need to be seeing more of this happen at community levels. We need to see more people kind of coming together and with thoughtfulness trying to do this work. You know, like I look at the wildfires in the West, and this is something that I've been getting really passionate about and saying, okay, we have these communities that when a fire burns through structures, like burns through an actual like lived community, we end up with incredibly toxic soil because of what we build our houses with, because of all the chemicals in our houses and in our garages and this, that, and the other. You end up with heavy metals, you end up with chemicals, you end up with dioxin, you end up with all these things in these post fire impacted communities, and people got to move back in, you know? And in most of these places, you know, FEMA will come and it'll do debris removal and hopefully remove all the ash and everything like that. But there is still contamination that people got to worry about. And they also have to worry about, you know, it's always people say flood, fire follows fire. And we often see like after a fire, we have a big rain and all that contaminated ash is potentially going into our water systems, right? And so these are things where you don't necessarily see industry rushing in there because it's not their fault. And government will be trying to clean up debris, but there's a lag time. And also once it's all done, there's still contamination. And I think those are situations where people could be looking at different bioremediation options, and it would be an empowerment kind of thing to the community to say, hey, we can do this, right? And again, it's like, how do we empower those communities with the resources and with the skills and with the trained up people to do that work? There's so much there. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how to answer your question, but it is.
I'm going to be a devil's advocate or just like have another opinion. And it's totally out of love. And I'm just like, it's for the intention of progressing the industry and how we can make the best decisions. And there's a couple of, I mean, there's so many great books out there. One of them, Bioreactor and Ex Situ Biological Treatment Technologies, was written in 1999. And it's basically the authors, they compiled like about 400 research papers at this 1999 International In Situ Bioremediation Symposium in San Diego, California. And they're talking about like specific events like in post-German military training grounds, and it was 18,000 hectares of contaminated soil and bioremediating it. Or, you know, in Bulgaria, there's like, let's see, this huge plot of oil remediation. And you know, the classic book, Mycoremediation, Fungal Bioremediation by H. Singh is like 600-page book, and there's tons more, and they talk about it on an industrial scale in industrial industries. However, it's like it's not for the average person. Like no person who wants to get into grassroots can do the technologies that they're talking about, because it's huge bioreactors and like unbelievable amount of engineering. They are like bioengineering the enzymatic metabolite processes, like they are creating new strains of fungi, yeast, like they're working with plants, they're bioengineering plants and making these like unbelievably elaborate systems that are very expensive and require like very, very ingenious engineering systems and like doing it on a massive scale. So I'm curious, like, I love grassroots. I think it's amazing. I'm just curious, like, where, like, should people have to do it themselves? And like, I mean, this book, The Bioreactor and Ex Situ Biological Treatment Technologies, some of the presenters were, you know, just flip into the page, were from like US Air Force and like, you know, and from industries. And something that I was talking to, I was in Ecuador studying different ecosystems and like human effects on different ecosystems and how we're bottom line just fucking it up, and industry should have to pay for those things. And like, where is the line between those companies who the oil company, you know, cleaning it up, and then just like the people who live in the city who just like, wow, you just dumped a bunch of pollutants on us. It's up to us to study all these complex systems and just kind of like grassroots, get a group together and do it ourselves when we have a 9-to-5 job and like, we don't really know what we're doing. But then there's a you know, this is super complex, but then, you know, a lot of these oil companies will pay for a quick and dirty, like they'll just burn the oil or whatever. So on in like an industrial scale, how do we get more clean, green bioremediation on an industrial scale rather than the like quick and dirty, I'm just going to burn this oil slick, or I'm just going to like bury this oil so it didn't happen and take a picture and like have a news company come and say, hey, good job, you know, it looks great. Where's that transition? Like, where is that, you know, is it more universities talking with these companies? Is it more grassroots people just making noise and like, and talking and to these, companies and making it like popular and popularizing this, to a point where we are asking these companies, like, why aren't you using bioremediation instead of these like dirty, I know it's a very complex question, but I'm just
going to stop you there because you asked like 10 questions in there.
I did. I have a million questions. So I'm sorry for
all. I want to try to hit them all. So I have to remember them. So first I want to say is there is, I mean, this has been going on for a while, and there are a lot of, as you said, like with that book, you know, there has been a lot of research done into this, and there have been some large scale applications. I mean, I have a friend who, you know, well, I'd say more of acquaintance, but we met last year. We were doing some panels and speaking engagements together. You know, he was doing some really big scale phyto kind of aquatic remediation with floating islands at a scale that I hadn't seen, and a level of success. And he was working with a company, you know, and they were doing some incredible work in Asia with that, you know, and it's stuff that, again, people make their weird little like floating island super DIY here, and they're like, bam, and you're like, yo, there's people doing this in a bigger way, you know, and it can be done in a bigger way. So I think there's lots of examples like that. There's lots of examples of where people have done some big scale bio or phyto remediation or some big scale kind of microbial remediation. So I think all that is true. I think to kind of, why are people doing it? Why isn't industry doing it? Or, you know, like, it's their job. And that's something, it's a thing I've hit in quite a few places where people literally are saying, you know, this company is the person who's at fault for this contamination. And even if it's not the company, the government who permitted them, who allowed them to get away with it, and who kind of is kind of the guardian supposedly of all things, they're responsible, right? And that is 110% correct. And I agree. There's no devil's advocate with that. I'm like, yeah, that's real. The issue is that it doesn't matter sometimes, because if the company won't clean it up, like, so for example, oil spills, even in situations where they come in and they clean it up, there's some situations where they will pretty much their methods and kind of in the time frame that they have, they get about 10 to 15% of the oil. And then the rest is just like left in the environment. Not all the time, but that can happen. And just because of the way of permitting industry, that's what we would say is clean is not always what they would say is clean. And then they can get kind of the permit to be like, we're done. And communities are still kind of being like, wait, is that okay? Is that okay? Like in terms of, you know, like you often, one of the things they talk about in oil spill cleanup is natural attenuation, which is kind of a fancy word for being like, you know, nature will take care of the oil. And it's like, it kind of will, but it'll take a long time unless you do certain things to assist it, right? And so I think there are those places where it doesn't matter if it's not our job. It doesn't matter if it was somebody else's responsibility. There's times where you're just left holding the bill, right? You look at cities where there's been like, you know, you want to have you want to start a community garden and there's this lot that you've been given or you've decided as a community to take back, whatever it is. And you look at the soil testing and there's like a bunch of different things going on there, but it's from this old factory that went under like 20 years ago. And this was an illegal dumping site and this, that, and another. And you can't track and make those folks clean it up, right? It's this accumulation of toxic society. And I think those are those instances where you can, you know, I think it'd be great to, again, like, yes, government should be like assisting people and paying and doing stuff like that for it. And there should be other things for that. And we can try to lobby for that. We can try to, you know, again, popularize things and that can make those things more available. But also sometimes people just decide we're going to do it. I think the other thing to watch out for is in popularizing stuff. I think there's a really beautiful way where, you know, if you work with your elected officials, if you work with certain company folks and kind of build those relationships ahead of time, it means that when there is a disaster or when there is the opportunity to do some kind of remediation, you can actually go to them and say, what about this? Or, hey, you know, I've been talking about this thing for like 5 years or 2 years now, or I've invited you all these presentations. Why don't we try this, you know? And if that relationship is built and if there's respect there, then that creates an opportunity. Like I look at, you know, after the Tubbs fire in Sonoma County, you know, there was a community of really rad permaculture folks who mobilized. And I think because of some of the relationships that they had locally, and also maybe more of a friendly government that's more open to ecological solutions, they were able to do some interesting bioremediation installations to deal with some of that post-fire contamination. But they needed to get kind of the approval of, you know, like the permitting kind of the government folks, and they were able to get that. That might not be something you could get in other jurisdictions and other governments, but it might have been a combination of relationships, of also progressive thinking, of that knowledge of remediation and bioremediation being kind of already there. And I think that that's work we can do. We can prepare the places we are more for that, both in kind of really smart conversations we're having with some of the decision makers and also with having the solutions ready to go. This is the biggest thing. You know, if there's a spill or if there's not even just a spill, but there's contamination and a group wants to move in and start doing stuff, but they don't have the thing ready to do it, then it just becomes this hypothetical thing that people are talking about. But there's a company there with a product and that's ready to go, whether it's toxic or not. And if you're a decision maker, you're going to grab the thing that's ready to go, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're people who actually have, like I always wonder with micromediation, why don't we have more microfilters ready, right? Why don't we have more, you know, whatever it is in terms of bioremediation, the tools that we could use for response and recovery, we need to have folks who kind of have those ready to go. And that's a constant kind of upkeep thing because these are living beings, but it actually completely opens your options to being able to kind of get in at a certain moment because people always talk about disaster capitalism and a lot of companies kind of profit off that. Like when we have, there's that opening, that vacuum where people are grasping. Right. Where there's like kind of like the field has been cleared and, you know, these capitalistic extractive companies are like, boom, in there like a dirty shirt. You know, why aren't we ready in those places where it's like, you know, we have this post-fire landscape. Are we actually able to respond and do anything with kind of filtration, phyto or myco or otherwise? Do we have connections with potential bioremediation? If we don't have the resources locally to do it locally, do we have connections with certain bioremediation companies who love to kind of come in and pilot their stuff? Have we arranged meetings with them and local government officials beforehand so that they even know who those guys are? Like, I think there's ways to be really smart about this, but it actually takes strategy, you know, and just if there's a disaster, all of a sudden people just thundering during an oil spill at emergency response personnel who are drowning in chaos, that they should be throwing mycelium on it is just going to close doors unless it's done correctly, you know? And again, right. Done with that complexity of thinking and that like understanding your audience, right? And again, there's certain situations where you have to navigate those hoops. And then there's situations where nobody is paying attention and they don't care what happens there. And then I think you can come in a different way, you know? But I think it's highly complex. And I don't know if I hit everything you brought up, but there's a lot there. And again, to me, it's all things that I think the more communities are skilled up in how to do this work, the more we're going to see innovation, the more we're going to see, you know, really cool things happening. And as long as people are doing it, again, with that complexity, and it doesn't have to be the complexity of, like, as you said, some of these books and some of these studies are at a level that doesn't really appeal to a lot of people. But then it's like, know what you don't know and know when to call those folks in and when to have those relationships where you can bring in that super sciencey dude who, you know, wants to like get real specific about what microorganism is going to do what. Like, know that person. Call them in, right? If you're not really good at mycocultivation, although I'm sure on your show you want to push that everybody learns it, right? But if you're not the best person with cultivating mushrooms or learning how to train mycelium and stuff like that, have friends who are, or be connected with certain mushroom farms and people who are so that you can call on them when there's a crisis. Build that relationship, because most people want to respond in a crisis. And if things are ready for them, if relationships are built, you know, if people have the humility to know what they don't know and to actually call in the allies, then I think we can see incredible things happen.
Yeah, I feel like the health, it also is a holistic approach. Mm-hmm. We need this community of minds, and maybe that's where the issue is. So with that in mind, I want you to talk about any situations that you've witnessed, any like real life examples of grassroots projects that you've seen executed really well and that you were happy with the remediation, and you can like actually label this as a remediated site.
That's a good question. I mean, I would say that I've seen some really solid kind of more like university company projects that have been kind of fairly solid that way. I would say, you know, I met this man last year who's doing really good work, as I said, with floating islands. His name was Tom Duncan. And there was just, again, just doing it at a really big scale over in China and such. And like, they were rocking it. I always think I'm also really inspired. I've always been inspired by the work of, you know, it started out the Amazon Micro Renewal Project, but now it's called AmiSacho. Down in Ecuador, the work of, you know, some of the really powerful women who kind of started that project, and also the current really powerful woman, Lexi, who's rocking it and is doing incredible work in terms of being local in Ecuador, working with indigenous communities, trying to train people up in bioremediation, trying to cultivate, you know, the strains of mushrooms that can do the work when it comes to dealing with all the hydrocarbon contamination down there. That's a project that has had many different incarnations of itself. But you know, right now she's doing some really amazing work in terms of actually bringing bioremediation, courses to the community in Spanish, right? And training up indigenous leaders in that. Like, I think that's incredible. So I think those are some of the projects that come to mind. I always think of new stuff that Nance Clem is doing out in the East. And I do think, you know, the project that happened, I wasn't on the ground for it at all. The project that happened by some of the folks in Sonoma County in terms of the response to the wildflower contamination, I think, I don't know how it turned out in the end. And they didn't necessarily, I've read articles and stuff where they didn't necessarily get to do testing kind of before to kind of know, you know, the success on that. And they had to move really fast. But I think that is a neat project to look at in terms of, you know, the ability to actually respond to disaster, and that this community did it. And, you know, I might have done certain things a bit differently in terms of kind of the remediation stuff, but they organized, they pulled on allies, they pulled on local knowledge, and they kind of, you know, went kind of with the focus of how do we deal with this kind of toxic, kind of heavy metal, chemical laden ash that's going to be running off into our rivers when we have potential like salmon and stuff coming up soon or whatever. And so they did some really interesting kind of filtration stuff, and they mobilized hella fast on that. And I think looking to that for inspiration is I want to see more communities doing that, but also, you know, having more options at their disposal in terms of how to do that. So I think that's a really neat thing. And I think folks in the West are going to have to start thinking about that a lot more. I also think that when it comes to lead remediation, lead is a big one because we have a lot of lead in a lot of soil in our cities because of the lead-based paint we use, because of lead, gasoline, a lot of things kind of from the past. And that sticks around. That's kind of heavy metals, long live, you know. But I think that there was some neat stuff when I was doing research for the book, and I'm sure there's been projects since of people, you know, not just doing kind of work with things like alpine pennycress and sunflowers to pull up lead, but also looking at immobilizing it. And that's where you get smart, right? Like, yes, you can do something where you're like, we're going to do all these, you know, rounds of planting plants to pull up something like lead. But when you understand that lead does not really move that easy into plants, and that there are other things you can do in terms of trying to immobilize it if you're trying to make that site safe to grow on. And that's a whole mix of, like, you know, simple things like finding ways to put more phosphorus in the soil. Because when you put more phosphorus in the soil, you create lead pyromorphite. It kind of reacts with the lead and makes it even less bioavailable. You start there. You do things with compost. You mulch it so that the lead dust isn't getting on your plants, right? Isn't getting onto, like, people's shoes. You build up with sheet mulching. There's all these things where, you know, I saw some communities that were looking at that route. And I think that's smart. And it's something you got to stay on top of. But, you know, again, they were choosing what worked for their situation versus what looks sexy, right? And I always appreciate that. So I also think there's some neat stuff coming out in terms of research right now. Folks I know who are trying to do work with, you know, I don't know, like post-fire, again, trying to do work with some of the mycete, like the fungi and mycorrhiza and stuff like that. But it's not stuff that I know enough about to kind of bring up too deeply. But I just know that there's folks who are working on different things, and I think it's exciting. But to be honest, I have not seen recently like a project where someone said, we bioremediated this as a community from A to Z and stamped it. I haven't seen that recently. And again, I think that goes back to, I don't know, like folks just getting kind of either like wanting to focus too much on the things that look sexy and not necessarily on like the entirety of the work, or not necessarily like calling in their allies and really training up. But it doesn't mean they're not out there. I just haven't been kind of, I've been doing emergency management work for the last year. And so my head has been like deep in kind of climate chaos and dealing with floods and hurricanes and stuff. Doesn't mean that. So I might've missed something.
So I feel like this stuff is still very hopeful, and all the science that's out there, it's, you know, it's very compelling, and I have a lot of faith in it and I'm optimistic, but it seems like we're struggling with the actual application. Mm-hmm. So in your opinion, just with your experience and working directly with grassroots people, with these communities and knowing a bit of the science, and maybe Alex with your more expertise on like having reviewed these industrial projects, what needs to happen so that people can actually execute these projects as efficiently and progressively as possible?
I mean, I think some of that, yeah. And again, I think some of that is funding. I think it would help if there was more funding and grants for that. I think it would help, kind of like I said earlier, if universities were really trying harder to make their stuff a bit more kind of community based and relevant in the field. And I do think that there's some universities that have done that, don't get me wrong. But I think like just finding more ways for that to happen so that people have access to the labs and to kind of some of that kind of scientific knowledge without having to necessarily be that themselves. I also think like I had a few experiences in terms of responding to oil spills and having communities kind of call me in to kind of do presentations and to talk to them about spills. And what I noticed in every one of those situations was that I could come in and I could say, hey, these are all the options and this is what you need to know and this will work for this and this will work for that. And people were really excited by it. But I wasn't coming in with the materials to do it and with the staff and the equipment to be like, we're going to throw down this project for you. And that always was this dream of mine to be like, how do we create some kind of, maybe it's like a, I'm not a company person. I'm not a business person, to be honest, but I've always tried to be, I come from activism. So I've always been more about movements and stuff. But it, to me, I was like, how do we create some kind of business or kind of, you know, network of people who can like, when there is these disasters, have the ability to actually support a community by responding and showing up and saying, we can throw this down. And you don't, the thing with bioremediation is you don't just throw it down. You have to throw it down and then you have to steward it. Right? Like it's not, again, it's not that short-term application, but if there was kind of groups or organizations, maybe organization better, I like that, but like, you know, organizations or businesses that had the ability to actually show up and provide the services, especially to our most impacted communities, and not be charging like, you know, huge costs for that or having those costs covered somehow, I think that would make the response and recovery piece better. And then I think also, again, seeing it happen in certain places, to me, the more your locality has certain resources in place, the more mushroom farms that are nearby you that are like sources for spawn and for knowledge, the more people you have like composting businesses and huge like kind of compost tea makers or bioreactors, all these things, like the more kind of bioremediation architecture and kind of expert people, and not necessarily expert, but people who just are doing it, who have the skill sets and who are practicing it, not necessarily in its full application, but have the base skills. The more nurseries you have, all those things that are in your area, plus trained up people, the more you're going to see people able to pull together a response, especially if they've planned it. If you call in all those people in your community, you know, this guy's really good at compost and this gal's really good at microcultivation and this person has a plant nursery and this person, you know, kind of is connected with like some of the local council in your community, whatever. If you call those people in and you train them up and you guys say, hey, if this happens in my community, if there's a train that goes off the rails or this pipeline bursts or, you know, we have an opportunity to do X, Y, Z because there's a fire or whatever, what would we all do? How would we plan this? What are our pre-positioned resources? Who has the ability to do what? If you plan that before the actual thing hits, it means that you can mobilize. And it means that some of those roads are already kind of worn a little bit. And I think that would make things happen instead of that kind of that vacuum and that kind of frenzy that happens when we're trying to address a thing, you know? And again, we have the ability to practice this stuff because we're surrounded by, you know, contamination that we could be working on even not in a disaster. And then even if we're not dealing with contamination, this is what I always try to tell people, every single bioremediation thing that I talk about in Earth Repair in the book, it will just make the land nicer and healthier, you know? Like it's none of it, like doing micro installations, whether you have contamination or not, is just a beautiful thing. It's just going to bring diversity and mycelium and fungi, you know, like finding ways to inoculate mycorrhiza. All those things will just make your plants, just make your landscape better at holding water, better at navigating illness and stress in the landscape. And we sure have a lot of stress with climate change and things like that. You know, all these things that you could be doing, whether it's like adding, you know, really diverse compost, it's all making the land and the waters near you more resilient and more healthy, which makes your food more healthy, which makes your people more healthy, which makes it easier to withstand all the chaos that we're coming into. And so these are things we could be practicing all the time and also offering the earth as gifts because we've taken so much. And I know right now there's a huge kind of movement kind of growing, it seems, in the West around like these eco restoration camps and restoration. And they have some beautiful ideas. And it's like, when we're talking about restoration, we got to fold in remediation to restoration, right? And if you're not doing that, then you're missing out too. And so I think there's just a lot of opportunities, but I think a mix of it is people knowing what they don't know, skilling up, inviting the people in who do know something, and making connections and trying to build infrastructure in their community so that they can respond.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think like just making a site more beautiful and having people appreciate the land that they're on might solve the problem in the very beginning from ever tearing it down to build something toxic in the first place.
Yeah, and education around that. Like I know, again, it's like that's all that is huge. Like I know I was looking into stuff for fire because, again, I'm originally from the West, even though I'm living in like a major flooded, super wet place right now. I'm from Alberta. I love California. I love British Columbia. It's another home of mine. And I get really worked up about fire, right? Because that's what we're seeing in terms of the West, in terms of climate change. And there's a lot of reasons why we're seeing fire the way we are seeing it in the West. And a lot of it's coming to how people have managed the land and how we've oppressed Indigenous people and not let them do prescribed burnings and all this stuff. Like there's a lot of things of like that plus climate change leading to a certain thing. But now we're dealing with this environment of, you know, fires burning through communities, contamination from that, and everything that goes with it. And those also bringing to the light, like how we build and why we're seeing contamination is because of how we build and how we build with toxic things. But I was doing a bunch of research. I kind of am teaching it's part of an online series about kind of farmers and kind of resiliency and wildfire. And there's a little part of it on recovery and remediation. And so I was doing some research for the online teaching I was doing for that. And also trying to think of things for farmers, for example, being like, okay, if you're going to do remediation and you are a busy person and you're struggling because probably your house burnt down. So it's not like you have tons of time to be geeking out and grooving down on certain things. What are certain kind of remediation things you could be doing that actually would just help your land in general? you know? And, you know, kind of it was coming up in a lot of the research I was doing that cover cropping, right, which is something that a lot of farmers are really familiar with, and gardeners too, right? Cover cropping has this like double impact or triple impact in terms of remediation. Because if you're cover cropping with the right species, you'll find that some of the species of plants that we use for cover cropping and gardening and farming, whether it's clover, whether it's vetch, whether it's certain things like ryegrass, those things also are known to break down hydrocarbons and certain chemicals, right? Because of their kind of relationship with certain bacteria, because they're nitrogen fixers. And so there was this thing of being like, huh, you could be cover cropping. And even if you're not 100% bought into bioremediation, there's this remediation thing that's potentially happening there. And then there was recent kind of stuff that came out with how if you cover crop, it increases the amount of worms in the soil up to like double or triple. And we also know from bioremediation that worms not only have this incredible ability to kind of deal with certain contaminants and hyperaccumulate them and things like that, which is not the best thing for the worm, but it does do that. But also in their feces, they have a bacteria, Pseudomonas fluorensis, that is known to break down hydrocarbons and other contaminants. And so this cover cropping, this really simple thing, actually had this like, you know, multiple bioremediation effects. That's just cool to know, right? Like it doesn't always have to be super complicated. But at the same time, if you're kind of going for a low impact bioremediation approach where you're like, look, I don't have the time, but I'm just going to try the following things and I'm not going to test it, just know that you may or may not get incredible results versus some of these scientific things that Alex was talking about where it's like, yeah, if you go in like full on with some of these like really intense projects at a certain level, you are going to be getting bigger results. But if you don't have the money to do that, you could at least be doing this. And it may work and it may not, but it also could just have some general benefits. And those are the things that I get kind of stoked about. And again, I want people to hold that, not take it in this weird hero thing and say, I did this and I won and now the earth is healed. That's probably not what happened, but you did something and it did make a difference in terms of bringing healing and more resilience to the landscape.
Yeah. And there is a fine balance, you know, there's at one level, it's like, I can see if I was an oil company and there's a bunch of grassroots people cleaning up my mess, I would just kind of like brush my hands off and say, great, I can keep drilling for oil and all the citizens will just clean it up for me. So there's like an awesome, like there's certain instances where it's like, if you have your land and no one else is going to clean it up and the government's not going to help you and blah, blah, blah. Like, yeah, there's amazing, amazing techniques.
Or I want to get in really fast with that, because with that, it's like with major oil spills, you are not going to get the chance to get in there. Government will, emergency response workers, the company, government will push you out.
Right.
And totally. What they're doing because of liabilities. That's
right.
The game. And people need to be really aware of like, you do not necessarily want to be running into that because of the health impacts. I've seen
people. It's really serious.
It's incredibly serious and it will impact you for the rest of your life. But I think there is work in the aftermath when they've been like, we're done and it's not done, right? And I think there's also work in communities getting really skilled up because, or not just skilled up in the techniques, but also in understanding conventional remediation. And in my book, I have a whole chapter explaining how do you, like, what is a conventional oil spill cleanup? Because people need to know that when the government says we're dropping dispersants on this, that should make you alarmed. And I think there's moments where people can push because some ways that they clean things up are, you know, in the moment, it's the only thing that they got and it's not perfect, but it's the best thing that they can do. And that is true. But in other cases, it's about public relations and hiding it. And so if they're looking to do a certain thing like dispersants and it is not what should be happening and they're doing it and they're not necessarily letting people know, these are things that communities need to thunder about and need to kind of push their elected officials about, right? So I think fire mediation isn't just the thing of being like, we're going to go put mycelium on it. It's like also knowing when to criticize what's happening. Like same thing, we talk about the fire cleanup, right? And we say like, they're going to move all the contaminated ash out of these communities. Yay, it's clean. It's like, where did they put it though? Did they put it in a landfill somewhere that's going to contaminate somebody else's aquifer? Where did it go, right? We need to ask these questions because otherwise it's just like a kind of, we're all hiding the mess, right? And somebody usually, you know, indigenous communities and communities of color are the folks who are on the receiving end and the shit end of the stick for that.
Right. Yeah. And it's also a non glorious or pretty job is the legal route, which a lot of people don't want to do because it's not heroic, it's not pretty, it's not fun.
And a lot of times it's unsuccessful.
It's unsuccessful. It's like these big companies can hire the best lawyers on the planet. And like we're seeing with Chevron Texaco in the Sucumbíos region of Ecuador, where Lexi Gropper is working, or the AMP, Amazon Micro-Renewal, Amisatu right now is, like they've been in that lawsuit for 40 years and they just refused to pay it. So like there is a route of talking with your legislation and knowing the commercial practices that take effect and really, you know, having this alternative and knowing like the, and that's a whole route that, you know, we need people on the front lines working the legal route, you know, like Giuliani in Chile, you know, working to put fungi on the red list. Like she's doing not that pretty work. Like she's working with legislators and it's not heroic. I mean, it is heroic, but it's like a lot of work that people want to get their hands dirty and plant, you know, sunflowers and throw some mycelium and like feel it. But really the legislation is super, super crucial. And,
And I think the allies, like making the allies, and it's funny, I wrote my book, it was like 2013, and it's like, it's been like 6-7 years, right, since? And there's things I would change and add to that book. Like, it's like, I would love to add, there's a lot of things I'd love to add, to be honest. But again, it's been like 7 years, and I've learned different things in 7 years. But, you know, in the book, I definitely was like, how do you get around government on this? Because I come from a province where you have to get around government. Like, they are not on your side, you know? But depending on where you live, especially at the local level and also, you know, county level, whatever, it's like you can cultivate certain relationships that make people want to help you out. And again, you've got to kind of give them something they can work with, you know, and I think what people have to realize is that if you go to people and you say, hey, I'm going to be able to do all these things with like kind of stars in your eyes. And if they buy it and you don't actually deliver it and you do a shit job of it, you've hurt people coming after you, right? So if you decide to kind of like go and like try to push this forward in a world with like, you know, that route to try to make it more open to other people, you got to do it well and you got to do it in a good way, which means you got to be sharp and you got to do your projects well. But I think another piece, and it's interesting with you're talking briefly with the companies, is, you know, I had the pleasure of meeting this woman who had spent her whole life working in the oil spill industry, right? And working with these big oil companies. And I interview her in my book. And I love her. She's an amazing, amazing woman. She ended up, she was like in a position of power in one of these big companies. And she had been on the Exxon Valdez spill, which is that huge spill that happened in Alaska for all the millennials who might not remember. But, you know, she had been on the Exxon Valdez spill and she had seen kind of how the way that they cleaned it up really impacted the workers. A lot of workers, cleanup workers, died because of the contamination that they were exposed to doing oil spill cleanup, right? And she had ended up having huge health impacts and almost dying herself, right? And
because the dispersants, right? They made it more toxic.
It was like solvents. It was them not putting on, like they didn't tell the workers the right gear to wear. Right? Because they didn't want it to look toxic when the media was there. So they weren't kind of being like, hey, y'all need to all be wearing respirators and all this stuff. And I think that still also taught people a lot, but in terms of what to do and what not to do. But then, hey, the BP spill came and some of the same mistakes were made and the same casualties in terms of people struggling in the aftermath, in terms of the communities closest, the first responders, the cleanup workers, right? And so this is huge. And that's another thing about bioremediation. It's like, you know, A, you're not dealing with some of the like the chemical things you would use to clean up aren't there, which is makes it an easier response. But you are still in these contaminated landscapes exposing yourself to things. And people really do need to think about the protective gear that they wear and the medicinals that they kind of work with after, right? But I was going somewhere else with this, although I'm happy to talk about that if you guys want. But with this friend of mine that I met, she was in a position of power when there was a spill that happened in Washington State. And she, because of what she's seen on Exxon Valdez and because of some, I can't remember if it was some scientist or who kind of got to her beforehand and were all like bioremediation. She pushed and chose with that spill to do bioremediation, to do bacteria. And she took heat for it. because it doesn't look as good to the media. You know, you have oil coming on a beach, and instead of having people frantically cleaning it up and looking like they're trying so hard, you know, although they're only making it worse because they're just submerging it with the pressure washing. But instead of doing that, she had people spraying like, you know, like fertilizer and stuff on the beach and like to kind of make the bacteria grow. And they were working with certain kinds of bacteria and everything. And the media would just had a field day with it in terms of being like, you guys suck, essentially. But because she knew what she was doing and she was like, no, I think this is going to work better. And at least it won't expose our workers the same way or whatever. They ended up doing remediation and, you know, it healed that land a lot faster than if they had done that traditional approach. And so I think there is a piece there where, you know, some of the times I tend to have like just from the way I kind of grew up in terms of the work I've done, I haven't always had the best experience with industry. But sometimes you will have the right person in certain positions. And that's the same in government as it is in industry, as it is with your emergency response personnel too, that, you know, with the right kind of relations and talking to them or whatever they've been exposed to, it can open opportunities. And I think we have to be aware of that. We can't depend on that, but it's something to kind of be open to and to kind of always keep that hand out and maybe try to suss it out. Because if you can get that on your side, holy crap, it's going to make it easier. But if you can't, then you're dealing with something a lot different.
Mm-hmm. So obviously everyone listening, this is an incredibly juicy topic and it's so complex. And as you can tell, we have a lot to say about it. And I'm just shooting off a lot of questions and we're responding really, really quick because we only have an hour. And
we'll go 10 more minutes.
So thanks, Lila, for coming on. And I feel like we could just keep talking for eight more hours and we might have to do an episode too.
But wow, cool.
just to wrap it up and like everyone again, get Earth Repair. Is there any other resources that you recommend people? Maybe if you have a website or if you're teaching a class coming up pretty soon.
Yeah, I have a website. I am not the best at keeping it up to date, but I'm about to kind of update it and redo it because it's been a long time. But if you want to get a hold of me, you can contact me through my website and it's www.earthrepair.ca. So that's one resource. The other thing is, that's a good way to reach. And then if you want to buy my book, I always love it when people buy my book and share it with people that you know. Ask, as I said in the beginning, ask your library to carry it. Because that means that it's available to a lot of people. You can get my book on the New Society Publishers website or from my website. You can also click on it. It's also available on Amazon, but Amazon is evil. So evil. Don't do it unless it's the only way for you to get the book. So I would say like contact me through my website. I am on Facebook. It's my personal Facebook. So if you do want to reach out, I'm always happy to talk to people about their projects. You know, if they're trying to do something and they have questions and they just want to brain jam, I'm happy to do that. If you try to friend me on Facebook, send me a message telling me why and who you are. Otherwise, I'm just going to be like, who's this random? So those are all things I would say. And again, it's just, you know, if you're passionate about this work, keep your eye out for different courses and try to skill up in the different things. Probably the best thing you could do is like go to a micro cultivation class, learn how to cultivate mushrooms. Learn how, you know, to really make incredible compost. These are things that like you learn some of these base skills and it kind of makes a lot of this work a lot easier. But I would say kind of do that. And if you're someone who is somehow in university and you're doing this work, push your professors, push kind of, you know, your projects to be applicable to community, to have some kind of component that is educational and that is actually dealing with something that's, you know, a real impact. I think we would all benefit from more of that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for all of your offerings, Lila. And we have one more closing question. And that is, if mushrooms had the mic and could say 1 to 2 sentences to the whole human race, what do you think they would say?
My first thought is not very eloquent, but I was just like, get your shit together.
Hell yeah.
You know, and I think mushrooms are very eloquent, to be honest. I think there's an element of get your shit together. And by that, I mean like skill up and start doing the work. And I think the thing with mushrooms is like, you know, to me, when I think of mushrooms, I think of this being that people don't understand. and that there is this beautiful complexity to. And I think that's the same as the work of healing and regenerating the landscape. And I think, you know, if they had the mic, they would kind of, you know, be asking people to kind of skill up and kind of approach this work with like a courage and a passion and a curiosity to just like get into those like nasty, weird places and make something beautiful, you know?
Amazing. Yeah, that wraps up another episode of Mushroom Revival Podcast. So thank you so much for coming on again. And this has been super juicy, really quick, a lot of information, drinking out of the fire hose on all things bioremediation and so much more to come.
And this is not our last episode on the topic. So
no, we'll keep looking around, diving into it. And you can download the book that I wrote in 2017 on microremediation. I just focus on fungi, but Lila goes into plants and bacteria. So if you want to get more of a holistic view, definitely get Earth Repair. I'm offering it for free on our website, and you can just download the PDF. We ran out of the in-print version. So if you like physical books, I'm so sorry. We're out and we're not printing anymore. So you can download it.
Or my book is free.
Say it again.
Your book is free?
My book is free.
Oh, that's awesome.
The PDF. Yeah. And we will put a bunch of resources in the show notes. And we love you so much. And stay shroomed.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Lila.